Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. This is your host, Sarah Chaffee. On today's episode, we'll be talking to our guest, Dr. Andrew Jones, about population genetics. Dr. Jones, would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I have a background in mathematical physics and computer simulation. Quite a few years ago, I read this really interesting article about evolution and statistical physics, and it was very interesting to see how we could use the skills of statistical physics to describe evolution, and that's partly what we'll be talking about. So I've recently joined Discovery Institute to work on questions like this full-time, which is it's wonderful.
Well, welcome, and thank you for coming on ID the Future.
Thanks.
So would you share with us about what is population genetics?
It's a body of theory that takes the simple biological facts we know about reproduction, about families, like Mendel's laws of inheritance, about chromosomes and fitness, and it transforms these into statistical knowledge about the genetic diversity of a population, things like allele frequencies and linkage patterns. So it's not about macroevolution. It's not about how new designs or body plans appear. It's about microevolution. It's about changes in gene frequency and how they correlate with each other. But it can answer questions like, how long does it take to get a certain type of mutation? How many of those mutations would go extinct? And how long would it take for a mutation to fix in the whole population? And one of the reasons we're interested in it is because it's an area of evolutionary theory that does seem to be quite rigorous and valid. It's very mathematical, and actually you can test it against reality in real ways.
So you'd say more so than most of evolutionary biology?
Yes, I would say so. Although I'm a physicist. I've followed ID for many years, and I've learned so much about biology from following an intelligent design movement, actually. I've been able to surprise biologists sometimes with what I know about biology, so I'll just say that.
So how does population genetics relate to intelligent design?
The short and odd answer is it doesn't, at least not directly. So intelligent design theorists tend to rely on arguments like irreducible complexity or the law of conservation of information, that if you see novelty appearing, it needs an explanation, and natural selection isn't a complete explanation. That's the kind of arguments that we make. So for us, the details of microevolution aren't as important. However, if you believe in macroevolution, it is really important because you have to believe that microevolution can turn into macroevolution. So one of the reasons we're interested in it is simply because other people are not convinced about ID. And we think we can strengthen the argument against Darwinian mechanism as a creative force we can show that macroevolution would take much longer than many people suppose, even if it did work. Even if it didn't have to deal with irreducible complexity, even didn't have to deal with the law of conservation of information, it would still take a lot longer than people suppose. So that's one line of arguments that we're going to look at, the waiting times problem for how long it would take quite a small change, like 3 or 4 mutations to happen. And then on the other hand, people have raised some arguments against specific cases of ID. So for example, there's the human single couple origin, and there's a guy called Dennis Venema who wrote a book, Adam and the Genome. There's been multiple articles on Evolution News recently, basically debunking a lot of claims that he made. But the particular claim was that the genetic diversity of modern humans is incompatible with the idea. And so Discovery doesn't take a position on whether there was a single couple origin or not, but we do take issue with the claim that the evidence says that there isn't, because the evidence, that turns out not to be the case. So there have been responses by Ann Gager, Richard Buggs, even Joshua Swamidas, who was really connected to Biologos, and it's even attracted the interest of a top geneticist, Steve Schaffner, at the Broad Institute. And it turns out Venema was wrong, and he misunderstood a lot of things. And so where we are at the moment is that there could be a single couple if it was, say, 200,000 years ago or 500,000 years ago. That takes in a lot of assumptions as well. So we're going to keep looking at those assumptions as well. It's a very complex question. The science is complex, as it turns out. And it turns out a lot of people, or a lot of the mainstream, don't have nearly as much certainty about the question as Dennis Venema did. He doesn't really have the qualifications in this area. It's a very interesting area to be learning about. So we're just turning over rocks, checking assumptions. One of the major ones is, from an intelligent design perspective, we can have founding diversity, or primordial created diversity, and that changes the math quite a bit. So we're doing interesting math that nobody's ever done before. And then the third thing is, it seems like for a lot of people, the evidence of microevolution is the number one reason not to believe ID, which is strange. I don't think this is consistent, but this is what a lot of people think. They look at endogenous retroviruses and shared SNPs, that's single nucleotide polymorphisms between species, sometimes called transspecies polymorphisms, and also syntony, which is the arrangement of genes on a chromosome. And they look at these and they say, well, chimps and humans are very similar, or gorillas, and gorillas are slightly less similar. And there are all these patterns that seem to be well explained by microevolution. And these aren't really relevant to ID because, of course, evolution could be pre-programmed or could be tinkered with as it's proceeding to add new genes and to add these innovations that really make the difference between chimps and humans. So it doesn't directly challenge ID, but we want to check just in case, because if this is the main reason people don't believe ID, we need to knock it down. If it's wrong, and it's wrong, we need to knock it down. So that's why we're interested in it.
So it sounds like population genetics is good background knowledge to evaluate evolution.
Yes, certain aspects of evolution. These are the more objective side. This is where you're actually measuring things rather than telling stories. So that's why it's more objective, more mathematical.
So what is genetic drift?
So this is interesting. So usually we think of evolution is proceeding by natural selection, but over the years, mainstream scientists, everybody's come to realize that actually evolution is mostly random. It's partly just because there's so much change that has to happen, and partly because selection effects aren't actually that strong on most mutations. Most mutations are neutral, and then they fluctuate just by random statistical effects. And this means that most mutations, when they first happen, they actually, most of them just go extinct straight away, and only a few of them are fixed. So that can tell you something about the age of an allele as well. So the ones that are most frequent, you can tell, or yeah, you can assume that they didn't appear yesterday because it takes time for them to become common in a population. So frequent alleles are generally assumed to be older mutations. Now we can bring to the table another possibility, which is that they were designed variants. So maybe not all the genetic diversity in populations is due to mutation. Perhaps it's due to an original or primordial design. So that's something we're going to look at. It also means that most permanent changes, on evolutionary theory, most permanent changes to the genome are not due to natural selection. They're actually due to this random drift. And I think that's pretty interesting too.
So that idea of chance and neutral drift being more important than natural selection, that's not something you hear very often.
No, it isn't, but it's very important amongst evolutionary biologists. There's an important debate between the neutralists and the Darwinians, and sometimes we get told off for describing everybody as Darwinians when they say, but we're really neutralists. So it doesn't mean quite the same things it means in everyday English, apparently. But it's very interesting if you think that what they're saying with neutralism is that really they're saying evolution is random. And I mean, I can't help but agree. There are lots of us have been saying that for a long time.
So another concept that relates to population genetics is linkage. Can you tell us about this?
Okay, so this is the idea that genes are arranged in a line linearly on chromosomes. So that means that when one gene gets copied, it's likely that its neighbor is going to be copied at the same time. So you can think of it as genes traveled with friends. And it means when you measure the frequencies of genes, they'll tend to be correlated. Now, there's another process called recombination or crossing over, which is when two sets of chromosomes, you cross them over, basically. It's hard to explain without some pictures. So that tends to break up the connections between genes, but it takes time. And the closer the genes are, the less likely they are to be broken up. So they're more linked, and that means you're more likely to see statistical correlations. And this is really important for understanding disease. So they'll look for sites that are linked with disease, that are correlated with disease, but it might not be that they're actually the cause of the disease. It might just be that they're close to the gene that causes the disease. So this is an important concept that population geneticists and geneticists in general use and look at. But it's important for us because we're looking at the statistical properties of genomes.
Interesting. And another concept that's used in population genetics is effective population size. What's that?
Okay, so this is a general feature, is that reality is complicated. but we like to have simple models because we can understand them. So we have to make simplifications. Now, the simplest model of population genetics is a single population with random mating, and there's no structure in it. Everything's random. So if we make that our base model, then when we look at a complex reality with complex family patterns, like non-random mating, like monogamy or even polygamy or something like that, or geographical subregions, races, and those kinds of separate populations, and also how populations grow and then suddenly crash, maybe due to climate change or whatever. Effective population size is, it's like a fudge factor. Is we can take a lot of that information and we can just pretend that we have one population with this population size, even though that's not quite the truth. It's a way of simplifying the maths. The maths is almost the same if we do it that way. So it really controls the rate of genetic drift. It controls the rate at which gene frequencies change. I hope that makes sense. So the other thing is, it's still an approximation. And sometimes you can assume an effective population size is all you need to know. And sometimes that's not true. Sometimes you do need to know other things. Sometimes the approximation isn't good enough. But that's all I can say in a short time.
So it sounds like this is sort of estimating what kind of population size, if evolution were to occur, that it would have to work within.
Yeah, it's an estimate of the real population size, but it's not necessarily the real population size. The real population size can be very different. So, for example, if you have non-random mating, then the effective population size will be much smaller than the real population size. On the other hand, if you have populations subdivided into geographical regions, like all over the continent of Africa and Europe and Asia, then the effective population size will be much larger than the real population size. So it's a little bit complicated, but it's a useful approximation. It's like a way of mapping from a complex model to a simple model, and lots of population geneticists use it. It's a very important concept.
Another term related to population genetics is coalescent. What is coalescence?
Okay, so coalescence is an important concept that's come out in the last few decades that really helps the maths, makes it a lot easier, and I think is really cool if you're into maths and models. So coalescence is the opposite of branching. If you imagine a tree trunk and you follow it up, and it'll break into smaller branches and then smaller twigs and then leaves on the end. The problem that we have usually is that we're looking at the leaves, we're looking at the final products of evolution or microevolution, and we want to figure out something about the tree. So we have to do branching backwards. We start at the leaves, and then we coalesce onto the twigs, and then we coalesce twigs onto the branches, and then onto the trunk of the tree. So one way to think about this would be, consider asexual bacteria. Now, they're useful because each bacterium only has one parent, whereas humans and diploid organisms have two parents. So one parent will have many children. So if you go forwards, you have a branching from one parent to many children, to many even more grandchildren, and so on and so forth. But if you run that backwards, this is called coalescence. So you get many grandchildren coalesce to a few parents, which are the children of the grandparent. So you coalesce to one. So the further you go back in time, you have fewer lineages, and it actually means you've got a lot less calculation to do. So it's efficient to compute, which is cool. It means that the further you go back, you will eventually get to one lineage. And what's interesting about that is that if you've only got one lineage, you've no more information about the population size. So there'll be one line of descent, but there might be millions or billions or trillions of other organisms living at that same time, but they just don't make it down. None of their descendants make it down to the final generation. And that's interesting to the question of the single couple origin, because it means that past a certain time, we can't really tell whether the human population was 10,000, as is commonly assumed, or just two people at some point. So that's an interesting point. So the same kind of process happens with humans. The difference is humans are diploid. That means we have two copies of every chromosome, and we have recombination, which is the splitting of the genes between chromosomes over time. Human genes are arranged into haploblasts, which are sections of chromosomes where recombination hasn't happened. And each of those coalesces separately, but because of recombination, they all take different paths from our ancestors. So it just gets a lot more complicated to think about. We have these things called ancestral recombination graphs that we have to think about. All that Ola Hosier is a professor of genetics and mathematics in Sweden that we've been working with, and he wrote a simulation that I've been implementing, which uses coalescence theory to work backwards, theoretically, from the current human population backwards in time to a possibly a single couple, possibly to an ancient population, to see what happens. That's some of what we've been working on, and it's very interesting.
That's very cool. It's very interesting to be able to examine that human origins question more deeply. And it's something that a lot of ID proponents seem to be curious about. So thank you so much for sharing with us about population genetics.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This has been Sarah Chaffee for ID the Future. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.